The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
And joining me right now on the podcast, and of course, catch us in video live right here. And Paul's looking smart as ever. I've made a bit of an effort with the shirt, but who knows what's going on down below. It's a bit like the markets. You know, you can see what's happening at the top of the markets, but what's the worry below, the undercurrent that people are worried about? You're right, fella, how's things anyway?
Yeah, I mean, you know, actually on the markets, etc., we've had some pretty monumental sort of like macro news. It does seem as though, you know, calling Houston, we've got an inflation problem both sides of the Atlantic. I mean, the UK, it means that interest rates are going to go up more than previous expectations. So we look as though we're going to go from around about 4.5%. Currently, the Bank of England is going to lift that by another quarter percentage point next week, and then probably top out at around about 5.5%. And then we had some huge news really overnight. And we had a relatively sort of in-line inflation report print coming out on Tuesday from the US. But what's been, you know, stood out to me for the last couple of months, and I've been sort of banging the table here, is that really we've got entrenched wage inflation, and that's really been worrying the Bank of England and the Federal Reserve. And nobody was expecting what Jerome Powell was going to say yesterday. I mean, he came out with a real hawkish hold or a hawkish pause, and the dot plot, which is their the Federal Reserve Board members' predictions of what their economic conditions are going to be, is suggesting there's going to be two more rate hikes on top of the, you know, existing level, which is just over 5%. So it's going to go to around about 5.5% by year end, on the basis that the economy is hotter than they'd previously expected, and then will probably stay higher as well going forward. So it all comes down to this whole inflation sort of like, you know, sort of like conundrum comes down to what a wage is going to do, and has it gotten entrenched? And one's obviously problem from the pandemic was that the participation rate went down because people dropped out of the workforce. And then we got a reopening, and it's meant that essentially, you know, a lot of companies struggle to actually hire, pushing up rates. And now they're in this stage whereby they got rid of everybody at the start of the pandemic, and they're a bit cautious about getting rid of anybody again. They want their own labor hoarding. And therefore, it's great for the economy. It keeps letting, you know, puts money into people's pockets. But really, 3.5% in the States on employment is too low, probably. I know it's a horrible thing to say, and probably 3.7% is too low in the UK to have stable wage inflation of roughly around about 2 or 3%. Not on both sides of the Atlantic, it's still over 5%, and there's no signs of it imminently coming down, given that the, you know, there's still plenty of job vacancies. And just look at the number of strikes. I mean, this side in the UK, we've got, and in France and stuff. So yeah, we've basically got interest rates going up on both sides of the Atlantic. And I suspect the ECB today will also hike interest rates largely on the back. And what that means, this is the thing, is what it means is that the cost of capital for companies is going to go up when they roll over their debt. And so that's going to hit more on the small and the mid cap. So we've just got to be careful, as we've said many a time, you know, when you look at buying companies, have they got strong balance sheets? And have they got recurring revenue streams to be able to get them through a sort of like a tougher period and roll over that debt? Because if they haven't, then it's going to be really painful.
Yeah. Do you know what? I was really surprised. I normally put alerts on, but I looked at the two-year yield, a UK government yield, and, you know, if we go back with the deadly duo, Truss and Kwarteng, and, in September...
Man and Robin.
Yeah, in September, you know, 27th of September last year, it got up, it peaked up, very quickly went up to 4.7, 2-year yield. And now, it's just gone above that. It's now at 4.84. And you're thinking, wow, it's a gradual rise. So it's normally the acceleration that scares people, but that says a lot, doesn't it? Now, what was the reason? I did watch a bit of, my wife talking in the background, I did watch a bit of Jerome Powell last night, but what was the reason for the pause? If they're going to continue to raise rates, and I did see Jeffrey Gundlach of Double Line Capital saying, they're not going to do it. They're not going to go any further. That's it. He thinks that's done. And I think that, what was the point of pausing there? What was the reasoning behind that?
Well, basically, they have this blackout period where none of the actual Federal Reserve members can talk 2 weeks before a rate rise. So none of them have actually been talking to the press. But the week before, there's about 10 of them who all did. And the majority view came out that they were going to pause. And that's what they signaled to the market only sort of like, you know, 20 days ago, 15, 20 days ago. And on that basis, it sort of kept their hands tied that they were going to pause rather than actually hike. And that's the reason why, in my view. I just think it's because they'd indicated so much immediately before that blackout period that really it would have been a bit stupid to hike, having said and indicated only 15 days ago that they were going to pause. What yeah. then the come then is what did that inflation print really change it? And it didn't, but what did, and you could say it did, was the hikes in Canada and Australia and the higher sticky inflation we have in the UK, plus the strong and consistently strong wage growth in the US. And I think that's what sort of tipped the balance that they were going to go for a real hawkish pause, i.e. such that until wages and salaries start moderating, then we're going to basically nail it going forward. And I think that's what changed their mind in between.
Do you know what? Part of me is like, maybe we'll get through, scrape through with it. Maybe we're in recession a little bit, you know, if we get revised figures and all that stuff. And we'll say, oh, we were in recession. That's why it explains why the market's been like it is for a while. But part of me thinks when you look at certain indicators, like the yield curve, again, now it's gone back to almost 1% or 0.9%.
Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it?
It's crazy. It's never been, like I said, it's never been that bad in 40 years. Now, to point out what, you know, for people, the inversion of the yield curve, that has predicted the last 10 recessions, you know, since 1955. That's a very accurate indicator. And it's the worst inversion it's ever had in this time. So I'm just thinking, there's something wrong here. And part of me thinks there's something wrong. That's why I've got, you know, I'm cautious. That's why I've got cash and stuff. And I just think it is true that the Fed pretty much are driving using the rearview mirror. And, you know, you're going to crash. And they're going to crash the economy. Like I said, you know, they've been lagging behind everything. We don't know the effects of this. Like I said, we've already been at these heightened interest rates for a while now. And we don't see the lag effect. And I do think, you know, that I sort of agree. I don't think they'll rise anymore. I think they'll start seeing deteriorating economy, you know, metrics coming out. And they realize, oh, in fact, we realize then. And then it's almost like turning around a big tanker. You know, you've gone too far. You've got to start breaking a mile before, you know, you see the coastline. You can't start breaking 10 yards before, put it in reverse quickly, because then all hell will break loose. Part of me is in that camp, you know, thinking, yeah, something's gone wrong. They've gone too far. And something, I don't know what it is, but deflation, I don't know what's happening. It'll take a long time to wind us back. But part of me is very cautious and very worried. That's why I hold, you know, about half cash.
Let's be clear about it. Higher interest rates are good for savers like you. You know, you basically got higher cash because you get more on your interest. You're now getting sort of if you put it wisely, you're getting 4 or 5 or 6, maybe even 6% on your cash in a sort of like, you know, an FCA supported bank. So it's not, you know, it's pretty good. I would say I wouldn't criticize them by looking in the rearview mirror. I'd actually say what they're doing is actually looking forward and saying, okay, we all accept, particularly in the States, inflation is coming down, and we see that through the stats. That's the rear view mirror, etc. But push the clock forward 6 months at the end of the year. Where are we going to be? And the problem that they have is that such that if we haven't nailed wage inflation, which is such a big chunk of the corporate cost base and the, you know, the economy, if we haven't hit that one over the head and knocked it down to really less than 4%, which is no sign of it doing so at the moment, unless we have done that, then we're going to get to a stage where inflation's going back up. So it will come down, maybe even hit 2%, maybe below 2% in the short term. But by the time it gets to the year end next year, it's going up again, unless we've really sort of lanced that boil. And that's the problem that the UK, the Bank of England, the Federal Reserve and the ECB are struggling with. How sustainable is the decline in inflation? And that's what people are missing. They think, oh, it's down. Fans, we've solved the problem. Well, frankly, it isn't, because the biggest driver is wage inflation. And unless that's gone, then it doesn't matter. Your offsetting of goods inflation is only a matter of time.
Yeah. But to look at, you know, commodities, for example. So they've been, they're on the floor pretty much. You know, they've been bumping on the floor. I mean, you know,
oil's about $70, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it's, it was coming down from 125. And it's, it, even though the, like I said, the Saudis and all that are trying to say we're going to reduce production, it, it has a little blip. But hardly anything. It goes back down a little bit, and so that's a little bit worrying. Just commodity prices. And I think what's, you know, what's going to stop wage inflation in the end? What they have to do, like I said, they're not going to admit to it. What they have to do is slow down the economy. That's and
well, that's what they're doing. It's a blunt tool.
Yeah, exactly. And job losses will happen. And so I think, but again, very blunt. How can they predict how bad that's going to get? The slowing down of the economy, and I don't know if they do. And I, you know, so they
haven't. No. Okay, right. They just haven't talked about it, right? The, just the mechanics. Yeah, you stick your foot down on interest rates. Okay, it shoots up. Right, you've got a participation rate which is relatively low because of obviously long COVID and stuff. You've got corporates hoarding it. Yeah, so you keep your foot down on the, unfortunately, the interest rates pedal until you, because you're playing chicken with the corporates, until the corporates basically said, right, okay, I can't afford to hoard labor to carry too many people and then start shedding. That's the problem. So when you come back to your question, how long is it going to take? It's really, you're playing chicken with corporates to decide how long are they going to labor hoard. And you've seen it in the tech, they've started to shed, but it hasn't lock, stock and barrel started elsewhere. I mean, you've seen it in places. There are a number of old economy stocks are shedding it. The problem is that it's going to take longer in Europe and in the UK than it is in the States, where the labour force flexibility is much, you know, much easier.
But so, how long does it take, that lag factor, like I said, how long does it take before they start, say, for example, hoarding labour, getting rid of labour, laying off people, and then seeing prices come down sustainably? How long does that take? What I'm worried about is the lag factor.
6 to 12 months.
Yeah, exactly. The deteriorating economy for 6 to 12 months before they even adjust interest rates. So that holding higher for longer, how much
in
effect,
the UK,
you know, deterioration will that have on the real economy?
Yes.
Before people say, oh, hang on a second.
Yes.
So, yeah, so that's the thing. But talk about predictions. Your prediction was spot on. When we talked about Plarian last time, Thursday.
I have to apologize. That was pure fluke.
Okay? I know. It was.
I had no inside track, I can promise you.
I was going to say, some people may think we have inside track here, but we were talking about what's happened with Plarian, and we, you know, said pretty much, we know it's world-beating tech because they've had over 100 peer-reviewed papers on their technology. Mm. And we're talking about, you know, institutions like Cambridge University, you know, Cincinnati sort of Children's Care, sort of really, you know, key opinion leaders using their technology, publishing papers, and yet they hadn't signed any sort of major deals here. And I said, you know, and I said, they've got one or two sort of company, hospitals signing up, and you said, what they need is a big MRI manufacturer to come on board. I said, yeah, that's the way to roll out, you know, very quickly. And then the day after, it came up with collaboration with Philips to be featured. Yeah. So Philips is one of the top three. You know, you've got GE, Siemens, Philips, and these MRI manufacturers. And now they are going to install Plarian's technology in that. And that's, to me, that's excellent. It's not exclusive, which means GE and Siemens will... I just think if you are GE or Siemens and you haven't got the best tech in your machines, then there's going to be less hospitals using them. So going forward, I think there's scope for, you know, these other big manufacturers to incorporate that in there. But that's very good news. A good starter, that, you know. But
well, I haven't got any other predictions like that.
What's the lottery numbers? Yeah.
Other than that, actually, for there's two companies. I just want to give you an update on news. And I know one you used to own, or we may still own, I'm not sure, but it's Verici DX. And they came out with prelims, audited results, last week, all in line, etc. But they've got some sort of, they've got pivotal study results coming out for their second sort of like lead test, the Clarava prognostic, which allows doctors and patients to better sort of like predict whether a patient, how a patient's going to react to a donor kidney transplant when it's put in, and then to adjust the actual treatment. So it's going to be really, really useful. There's no comparable test. There's nothing out there that that doctors are currently using. So if it comes through its pivotal validation study, and with the results out imminently at the end of, by the end of June, then this will be a real feather in its cap. And just to give an indication, the first one, Tutivia, which is a diagnostic eye post-operative test, and it passed that validation study with flying colours. Now, what this means to me, and this is where I come back to sort of Polarian, etc. Once you've, if that comes through, and I've got no reason to believe it won't come through with sort of flying colours, you've just basically created a platform of diagnostics, both pre and post transplant, that is pretty much unique. And so the technology as a platform works, so you can roll out further diagnostics like their Protesia one, which is a longer term kidney transplant graft diagnostic. But what it means then is that, you know, M&A, et cetera. One, it puts you in a good position in terms of, you know, developing and commercializing that suite and that platform of products, because it's pretty much unique, best in class. But equally, at this such ridiculously low valuation, hey, you know, if you're a big diagnostics company in this space, I don't know, somebody like CareDx or, you know, Exact Sciences or Roche Technologies or anybody of world-leading technology, I mean, you just must be salivating. Just thinking about, you can pick this company, even if you pay 100% premium immediately. So when it comes to my second prediction, I'm not predicting that Vreach is going to be taken over at all. But all I would say is that once you've got that validation of the technology, like Polarian did with its FDA approval, once you've got it, you open doors to the biggest players in the industry. And therefore, you have a seat at the table to decide about how you develop that business, whether it's organically, whether it's your own acquisitions, or alternatively, whether you are, you know, basically bought by a bigger player, because you have a unique platform that has huge barriers to entry and marvelous IPR. So I don't want to get ahead of myself, because we haven't had that those second studies, but I'm hoping over the next 2 weeks to speak to the CEO, Sarah Barrington, who I've spoken to many times before, and I think she's first class, really, really good. I mean, so commercially astute, as well as, you know, obviously on the medical side, and she's got a great team. And if that comes through, and even if it doesn't, Tutivia is great. And so there's not plenty of other shots on goal, but I think it will, given that the direction of travel for the platform is, you know, passing the validation study with flying colours.
Yeah, no, I like Vreach. At the moment, I'm very skittish in the markets. I'm just saying we went to a point where, back in sort of March, we almost a lot of companies just massively oversold, and it, ridiculous. And in fact, Vreach went down to four and a half pence.
It's like, absolutely, and there was
90. It was 10 million market cap, and it's like they had that in cash pretty much. And I thought,
I know. That's and silly. It wasn't 90p.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I read the broken note on them, and they're saying that not only they've got best in class, but they've got first in class. And I thought, that's in an area that's quite big. And I did take a position. It went up massively, but I did put a stop loss in. It tripped out sort of 12 pence. But there's a handful of stocks, right, in the UK, MedTech, that you can see they are, like, it's, you know, best in class, first in class, and all that. And that but at the moment, it's that the market is not giving them any sort of validation or any valuation whatsoever. But they are, you know, it's worth keeping an eye on them. Vreach is one of the things I would intend to get back in. It's just at the moment, you know, I'm just worried where the market's going. It's like we have seen the start of a little rally again, I think. But along with, I think it's off the back of the, you know, American market, which is a bit crazy. But like Nasdaq, for example, it's nuts. And what's worrying is, like, I mean, was it top seven companies? In fact, you tweet that out from a top seven companies, 50% of the S&P 500 valuation, which is a bit crazy, and it distorts the overall view. NASDAQ is about 15% off of all-time highs. Is the economy that rosy? It's not. It's just nuts.
It's a crazy stat of the S&P 500. You know, you strip out the Magnificent Seven, who are up sort of on average 35%. But because they've got, if you add them all together, their weighting in the S&P 500 is about, I don't know, 40% or 45%. But when you strip that out, the rest of the 293 stocks are down year to date.
Yeah.
It's
just nuts.
So
on Vreach, how do you put, for example, a valuation on this? Because I looked at the market size, looked at how much they charge and all that stuff, and I'm none the wiser. I just thought at the time they had cash near their market cap, and considering they are first in class and best in class in a big area of unmet medical need, or you know, they haven't comparisons, but how do you value that, for example?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's difficult, isn't it, to a certain extent, but let's just put a, you know, it's, I've seen numbers of a total addressable market of well north of $500 million, okay? In fact, $700 million or even more, okay? If they just got, I don't know, 10% of $700 million, $70 million turnover, you know, this is a worldwide opportunity. Let's say in 5 years' time, that would be, as I say, $70 million a turnover. Gross margins on this thing would be 80%, you know, drop through. So, you know, they'd easily be picking up 30, 40% EBIT margin. So, you know, on that basis, they'd be doing, what, $20 million of EBIT, give it a 10 times EBIT multiple, $200 million in 5 years' time. What's the current cap?
It's 10 bagger, that is. Yeah.
Well, that's right. It's $20 million market cap. Yeah. And you discount back at, let's say, 12%, let's say use 15%, which would make the maths easy. That would be half, wouldn't it? So you get $100 million in today's terms compared to, you know, a net present value of $100 million compared to, you know, $20 million now. So it obviously, those are just hypothetical numbers, but you can absolutely see how there is. if you're a Roche or a, you know, basically Care DX or in, you know, another big diagnostics, you know, company, you just say, well, okay, I'll take that any day of the week. I mean, another one which falls into exactly the same bracket, which has world leading technology, who came out with some news, is Lung Life AI. Yeah, I mean, I underline the AI as well on it, and this basically does best in class or first in class, you know, lung cancer diagnostics, and it's going through its own pivotal validation study with the results probably in about 3 months' time, etc. Again, the shares have just been sold off. I can't remember what the market cap is, but I think it's below 20 million, etc. Big addressable market. They use circulating tumor cells. They did an initial pilot study to get before the validation study of about 150 patients. Mm-hmm. And that was basically just the result. The news was it just been peer reviewed by the medical industry. So they've been kicking the tires on this for over, I think it's over a year. So, you know, this, and what they've come back is that it's demonstrated significant improvements in the accuracy and sensitivity of diagnosing cancer patients in terms of once they've been sort of screened for by a CT scanner, it's then deciding, is the cancer or is the tumor, is it benign or is it actually serious and they've got to remove it? And that's been the biggest problem for the industry. And this test allows physicians and patients, using a simple blood draw, to do, you know, CTT testing, best in class sort of testing, etc., and come out with a positive result to say whether, yes, it is a cancerous tumor or whether it's a benign one and therefore we can leave it rather than having to then do a biopsy. So as I say, as a endorsement, you've had the best med heads in the world looking at this test for the last 18 months, 12 months, whatever it is. And they've said, yes, it absolutely stands up and it's best in class. Anyway, the main validation study results is coming out in about 3 months' time, and then they'll start the commercialization. And then they fall in exactly the same bracket as Verici, world-class technology, huge addressable market, and, you know, basically, they can either do it organically, they can do some M&A themselves, or they're going to be bought by somebody else, by a big... I mean, that really would fall into the Exact Sciences or even one of the big CROs who are looking to sort of expand into diagnostics as well. There's plenty of consolidation. So, yeah. I mean,
drop, didn't they, in the market recently? On the 9th of June, they just dropped. I saw that. At one point, it was like down 49%, and there's no news.
I know. It's
day.
Just, it's a huge,
26%. So,
it's a hugely illiquid stock, and somebody just dropped, I don't know, 20 or 30,000 shares, and it was absolutely nothing. So, I mean, all I would say is that price, when you get to micro caps, isn't a reflection of valuation at all.
Yeah.
Even when you get to large caps, a lot of the time, it's not a reflection of value. And this isn't. It's just frankly nuts. I mean, they're both, Lung Life and Verici have both got sufficient cash to get them through into mid 2024, so at least another 12 months. What's that? I mean, the market cap's only 11 million. And I know this addressable market is over a billion, lung cancer diagnostics. So
it's almost like, so it's almost like it's a strategy. Like we said before, you could take 1% in, of your total portfolio in a handful of these stocks that have, you know, big total addressable markets, very big growing commercial end markets, have some validation from bigger players. And just sit and wait, and because you're not overexposed, you wouldn't worry too much. Then once this is one start really moving, then you can invest a bit more in it, you know. So
another one in that. Let's just go through some of the healthcare news, etc. I mean, another one was Avacta, and I've said before they've got lots of shots on goal here. They've got their precision platform with the AVA 6000, which is going through your clinicals phase one A and phase one B to get that maximum tolerated dose and then the optimum dose and the efficacy data. So huge potential value upside there. They've got the Affimer platform that basically does diagnostics and testing, and then they've also been doing the acquisitions in the diagnostics, Launch Diagnostics last year, and then Coris BioConnect as well. Well, the news this week was that one of their joint ventures with Day One Pharmaceutics, they've basically reached a major milestone on the back of the Affimer technology, because they're using it to put into cell therapy and gene therapy technology, leading edge, etc. And they've met the targets that they actually required from, based on their on that science. So they've then been able to bump up their once the valuation's done, their shareholding within that joint venture. It just shows you that as an investor, what you can't see under the surface is so much bigger than what is actually the opportunity set. And, you know, it's that classic iceberg. It looks big on the upside, but actually it's enormous down under the water. Yeah. And they've just got really a treasure trove of real world-class IPR. And the hard bit for obviously the management team is making sure that they optimize all of those opportunities simultaneously. And they've got an excellent front bench. I did actually go down to their capital markets day earlier in the year, and I was really impressed. You had great presentations from right across the actual the company. So it's trading at sort of a quid. It'll just stay round about that until they get that major news where the AVA 6000 has finished its phase 1A testing to find that maximum tolerated dose, then goes into phase 1B, where it's essentially getting some efficacy data, and hopefully by the end of it come out with a good idea about the optimum dosage level for patients. Once that happens, that will be a huge value inflection event, because we know at the moment that the prodoxorubicin is safe, unless we miss it. Everybody's missing something. We know it's safe. It's much better than doxorubicin, the straight cancerous drug, and then it's all a matter of whether they do start seeing shrinkage of those tumors. So I'm hugely impressed. But we've said many a time, patience equals profits, doesn't it? As you're an investor, and you've just got to ride out the volatility, because it's extreme. I mean, super extreme in med tech.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what? Looking at where the share price is right now, I mean, they are at £1, but they've bounced off this level many times, and it hasn't been below this level since April 2022. When it was rising above that level, but then it bounced back down. It's bounced off it so many times, and it rises up to 180, 190, and come back down. So it's a good risk reward here for traders. It's like, it doesn't really go below this level. You could put a stop and just below that, because it doesn't really go below this level for asthma every year. So we'll see.
I mean, just to give you an indication, a potential realizable value, right? Chemotherapy is massive industry, okay? And there's plenty of big pharma who need growth drivers in oncology. One of them, just down the road from where they are, is called, GSK. It's got its headquarters in Cambridge. Avacta headquarters, well, actually, it's in London, but it's not far from Cambridge. And they used to have a diagnostics business in there in Cambridge. they've said themselves they're not going to be able to compete against the world leading immunotherapies that the likes of AstraZeneca and Roche and Merck have developed, and or even the real sort of like, you know, the niche cell therapies as well, the new ones, or the ADT, all those kind of, you know, real high end. They're going to go in somewhere else where they've got some strength. Would it make any? Would not make, you know, stupid logic if somebody like, you know, Glaxo or a Novartis or somebody like that decides to say, well, okay, this looks like a nice asset to pick up, and I can then take it through phase two trials, because if it gets through phase two trials, phase three is because then they've got all the historical data on doxorubicin, is almost a slam dunk. So phase two is the real killer, rural, you know, major, with a bit sort of like the major milestone to go into FDA. But hey, who knows? I mean, as I say, just on volatility, we got another one which has just been nuts, and we've been tracking it for 2 years. And I certainly like the technology, is portable oxygen concentrator, you know, sort of innovator, Bellascura. And it's just about met all its commercial targets. And, you know, it's actually needed some more funding, and we come just going full circle. It's been, you know, it's struggled to get funding this year, but has actually just done so, completed it. It did a bond issue, convertible bond issue earlier in the year for a roughly round about, I think it was $5.8 million, and then did an equity issue, a placing just recently, which the general meeting just approved for $3.1 million gross on sterling. So around about, I think it's, well, that gets to about $8 million, etc., just over. So they should have enough, and they've said in their trading that once that's gone through, they'll have enough cash to last them for this year. They'll have about $3 million by the end of this year, and that the money they've just raised will help them develop and to commercialize their next major sort of product launch, which is Discover, which is replaces their first lead product. And they can see that in 2024 and 2025 generating 50%, 70% of the total revenues, because it effectively, the big USP it has, it generates three times more oxygen by weight than the next leading, you know, portable oxygen concentrator. And just to give people, you know, understanding what these devices are used, they're used for by patients, you know, to treat COPD, you know, breathing difficulties and asthma and all this sort of stuff. And, you know, they're lightweight, portable, and they get people out of hospitals, importantly, you know, they just have a better quality of life, and it helps people like the obviously the NHS. And they've got some good, you know, good demand for it. So if you have to raise money, as we've said, the cost of capital is very high, and it's been expensive for them to do it. Anyway, they've done it. They've got over it. It's future-proof their balance sheet, so they can actually then commercialize the product. I'm hoping to catch up with the CEO, Bob Rauker, sometime over the next week or so, once the company now puts out its audited 2022 results and latest view in terms of commercializing that platform. But again, I mean, I think I'm not sure
down
exactly.
Down at 27 pence there. It was 130 like a year ago, yeah. Pretty much. It's like,
yeah. I mean, the last target price that the house broker had was 120, was 120p, which is Dowgate. But that didn't, I don't think, incorporate the extra share count that they've now got, so they'd have to readjust that. But it's again world class technology, and it's in med tech with huge barriers to entry. It's got FDA approval, it can now, once it's got its funding sorted out, it can now decide, you know, its own future, commercialize itself, you know, potentially buy people if it needs to going forward, or alternatively, you know, get bought by one of the big sort of like, you know, device manufacturers, which would not be stupid either.
Yeah. But do you know what? It's time for my weekly mention of Destiny Pharma, because I did a video on the weekend. And I delved a bit more into the CEO change, and I can't see any particular reason why Neil stepped down. But looking at the new CEO, you think, hang on, people sell first in this market and then think about it later. Doctor, you mentioned there Novartis, Roche, GSK. Yeah. Dr. Deborah Barker's worked for high levels of all those, right? Now, just, I'm not down, you know, putting it down on Neil, but Neil previously was an accountant from PwC. He stepped in last two PLC roles was CFOs.
I'm an accountant. What's wrong with an accountant?
No, but he stepped in, you know, last two roles were CFO roles. He's a numbers guy, which is a good thing. You know, with small cap companies, you need a numbers guy. But his specialization wasn't in anti-infectives, you know? So Dr. Deborah Boggs stepped in. Now, if you look at his CEO, I said, worked at Novartis, like at, what, 250 billion market cap, Roche, again, run at the same GSK, about 60 billion. But she's also, at Novartis, she had several senior roles, including head of development of anti-infectives. Right? Now, what does Destiny Pharma do? Anti-infectives. That's spot on. She couldn't be more, you know, suited to this role. And Neil beforehand was, even though he's very good with it, he took it, you know, it's from IPO and did very well. So this is a more appropriate line. But even so, the share price sold off. I think it's crazy, really. And she says, you know, my job now is to get in continued discussions on a partnership deal on their second lead asset, which is XF73. And like I said, this is wholly owned. It's twice the size market potential of the initial asset they've done a deal on. And so it's just crazy how people just sell off. And I think, looking back at the chart, £1.80 before they had any deal on these assets, before they raised cash, and yet it's at 30 pence. And I think, this is nuts. I mean, and I said, I've never seen, I don't know about you, you've looked at broker notes, I've never seen three separate broker notes with such a high upside here. And this is on the one asset. And this is, we are talking about 850% up. And this is talking about the market penetration of the M3, the first asset, not including XF73, which is double the size. So, and if you go through the broker, like I said, they look at everything, probability, market penetration, pricing, and there's variances on all these levels. And so they are very detailed broker notes. They're not just, it just chucked out there's a silly thing. And like I said, the three separate notes. But have you ever seen some kind of, and like I said, bear markets present this opportunity, whereas like before, from when they were at 180, then 268 is not that big a target. But we've had a big sell-off in the market, the bear market. Now at 30 pence, you think, this is crazy. Yeah. You know, so,
It's really, just to get the people's, you know, sort of highlight to people, valuation, when it comes to sort of like drug discovery businesses, particularly early stage, it's super difficult to get a, you know, a proper valuation. And I would, they're all done on risk adjusted. So, you know, what they're really saying is that they put a chance or probability of something happening, and then if it did happen, what would be the actual NPV upside? And therefore they get their, you know, the risk adjusted level. But in reality, what you're saying is that if it does work, then it's going to do even much, much better. But if it doesn't work, then it's going to zero, that asset, that candidate. Yeah. So that's the problem. It's just a huge divergence. So you just get these huge, big value events on important clinical trial data. So
they are going to phase three on M3, but XF73 looking to partnering deal going to phase three for that. But external European market research reports that XF73 is seen as very promising alternative to the current standard treatment by both clinicians and payers. The study suggests XF73 has the potential to replace the current standard of treatment as preferred by pre-surgical nasal decolonization agent. So an active partnering thing is happening right now. And Dr. Deborah, just have a look at Dr. Deborah Barker's background and then have a look at Neil's background, and you realise that she's such a good fit.
Yeah.
And so it's worth looking into that. But yet, of course, when a CEO steps down, people just worry, sell. And so hopefully there's a bit of churn in the stock there.
Do you still own them at all? Or have you basically moved on?
I still own them, yes. I absolutely still own them. Because I just think, when you look back, and really now, when sentiment's really negative across the market, and you realise it will change. We don't know when, but we know it will. You know, we will get back to a bull market. And there's times like this where you think, you look back and realise that was valued quite lowly compared to what it had. And if you go back to even like a year and a half ago, like I said, it was 180 a share, and they were less developed, they were less cash. And so there are massive opportunities in a bear market. And sometimes you've just got to hang on a little bit, and you will see volatility as long as you're not too, you know, overexposed. And like I said, you know, there's probably a good strategy in getting some of these, you know, companies we've talked about just now, putting very little bit of money into all of them and just sitting and waiting. Because one of them, all you need is one of them to do very well, and you can, you know, average up a little bit or invest a bit more in it, and it'll transform your portfolio, because they can be, you know, a world beater. They can be taken by a big company.
I mean... It's one of the reasons why I'm still relatively cautious on the economy, as we've discussed, but actually positive on smalls and mid caps, because there's so little liquidity out there that it's been exacerbating the selling that's driving share prices down. And therefore, when you look at it on a price versus value lens, then there's huge upside if you select wisely. So, I'm actually far more optimistic.
Yeah, it wouldn't take a lot for like some of these companies you've mentioned, like Verici, Lung Life, all that, whatever, to just double quickly because they're oversold. And you know, if you had a little bit of money in there, you just take out half because you double your money and just let it sit and wait, and that's it. There's no risk there for you whatsoever. So, you know, and because they're so oversold, some of these, it's crazy, you know. So,
yeah. What shares do you currently own then in that sort of like the other 50%?
I still own... XPF. I still own, I've mentioned Good Energy before. They've got now literally Good Energy. I mean, they've changed from they had a legacy business where essentially they had, you know, solar wind farms, all that stuff, and it was high debt, but they've transitioned to a new CEO. I think he's come from a money supermarket as well for that, but they're going to now, you know, a services company where they have heat pump installers, but also have feed-in tariffs and all the stuff, but they've got about 24 million in cash. And what are they at the moment? They've got like 30 million market cap. And last year they grew, profitable. They pay a dividend. I think this is a silly sold-off situation. They're in a very hot area, like solar panels, heat pumps, also feeding tariffs, all that stuff. And I think one of the originals of people believing in renewable energy, and most of their customer base are into that. And I just like the area they're in. I think it's a very hot area. Another bigger sort of, I've mentioned to you before that I did buy... which they've had a few problems, but I've bided my time as Alpha Wave. This is in
Did you buy it? Okay.
Yeah, not a lot, but because I've been watching them for a long time. And like I said, I waited for their final results to come out. Turns out the CFO messed up all the numbers. He was sacked, and they sacked him, so the share price took a bit of a dip. But one of the directors has been buying all the way down pretty much. And their compound annual growth is phenomenal. I mean, lots through acquisition.
But what do they do again?
They do semiconductors, all that kind of architecture, also connectivity to data centers, so low-cost connectivity. So it's very much this AI kind of battle. You're going to need a lot more data with AI. You know, there's a huge amount of data generated. And so they're doing that. In fact, they've just extended a deal, I think, yesterday with Samsung for their 3MN, so semiconductors, tiny little ones.
Three
nanometers. And if you look at the background of the directors there, they've all sort of come from, you know, previous sort of Intel, all these companies, and so I quite like them. The growth is excellent. I'm not quite sure in the valuation. I mean, it's not a huge amount of upside if you look at. It's hard to value these companies. You can't compare to American companies. I know Nvidia and all that. It's a 52 times sort of earnings, whatever. It's a nuts. But I mean, even on a basic sort of a level of in peers, I mean, I think three brokers have a target price of about just over £2 for this. But I mean. This is over the next year, that is. So, but the growth is phenomenal. It's a growing sector, and I quite like them growth-wise. But I don't know. It's hard to know. It's not really reassuring. Your company, there's a billion market cap, and the CFO gets sacked. You think, why would that happen at that level? And they're growing very quickly, you know, and they're acquiring companies very quickly. But it tends to be, but it needs a bit of housekeeping there because it's a little bit worrying. But the second grain is just very hot, you know?
Yeah, well, great minds think alike, because I've also sort of just recently bought a customized chip developer, which is called Sondrel. The ticker is SND, which is CEO'd by and was founded by a guy called Graham Curran. It's about sort of like, I think it's a sort of market cap, around about 30, 40 mil, etc.
Oh, is that all right?
Fairly small. It was. I mean, I've only got a half a position. It's 45 million. I've only got a half a position because I couldn't get liquidity into it. But essentially, they do designs for, they design, prototype, and deliver sort of like digital or small nanometer chips for, you know, customized specific applications, things into accelerated computing, AI, into electric vehicles, into, you know, all of these sort of like, you know, data centers and stuff like that. But it's the real sharp end. It's the accelerated sort of like, you know, computing side of it. So that's the sort of the synergy. And they're onto a huge, you know, growth trajectory. I mean, their reported sales from last year would over double what they were the previous year. They're about just over 17 million. And they're going up to around about, I think it's high 20s for this year. And they're up to over 40, et cetera. And I mean, I've spoken to the CEO, Graham Curran, and their IPR in it, yeah, is that they've been doing it for 20 years. They've got all the designs for all the chiplets that you then use and you put together to create these super chips for the likes of, as I say, could be any of the like Apple or people like that who want supercharged, customized, specific chips for them. You know, if you're one of these big sort of like, you know, product manufacturers and you want sort of like supercomputing power, et cetera, then you can either do two ways. You can either go and buy an NVIDIA chip or an AMD chip, which will do shed loads of stuff, cost you an absolute fortune, about $20,000, draws huge amounts of power and be able to do everything, but most of the stuff you don't want it to do. So you're wasting your money. Or you get one which is actually customized specifically for the longevity of that particular product. And this is what these guys do. They typically go, the manufacturer will come to them, they design a chip for them, which will take sort of like, you know, 18 months. They'll then prototype it, which will then tape it up and then get it etched, which is another 12 months. And then they'll basically deliver the actual chipset to them using a manufacturer like, you know, TSMC or somebody like that out in Taiwan, and deliver over the product life cycle. So they've got, you know, big visibility over their revenues. He's super confident over the long term. And if the shares come down again, I'll pick some more stock up, et cetera. But it was just difficult for me to put in a decent sized position. I've probably got about a third or a half of what I want, but it's in the same sort of space. I would class this as a stealth play into generative AI or into all things accelerated computing, because it's a cheap entry in it with expertise, large, you know, IPR. As I say, just reinforce what is their, you know, USP. It's 20 years of developing chiplets that they then put together, i.e. they own the IPR, to create a solution on a chip for a manufacturer or a major chip, that design then goes to the manufacturer. They own it. They own that IPR, but they don't own every little intricate bit that goes into that particular IPR. That's held by the company, like Sondral. And then they can lift and shift those chiplets into other designs that come forward. So,
that's pretty much what, AlphaWave do, but they're a bit bigger, close to a billion. But AlphaWave, by the way, I know they've got a hyperscaler. One of their clients is a hyperscaler, which I don't know if you know about those guys. But
I do. Yeah, it's basically Amazon Web Services or Google or Microsoft. Good,
yeah. So they've also got Samsung as a client. And I mean, and if you look at their compound annual growth top line, it's 187%. You know, over the last 5 years, so it's been growing very quickly. And the guys in that company, quite interested in Sondra because it's a lot smaller. Are they able to, can they get these big sort of, or do they need them, the big sort of customers, the end clients of that?
Yeah, I mean, their contracts tend to be 10 million plus. £10 million plus. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, their design contract can be 5 million easy over 18 months. Their prototyping can be 1, 2, 3 million. And then it all depends on how much the product goes in. You know, obviously, they'll get, you know, the revenues coming off when it goes into production. So that can be as big as, big as your life, 30, 40 million, et cetera, depending on how long it is, over 10 years or however, you know, how much the product's in place. But they're talking to the big guys to be able to do it. Yeah, absolutely. And they have a track record of delivering it.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just like in that area, isn't it? It's very much worth it getting a toehold in this, because we know one thing, you know, more data is needed, more speed is needed, and also if you can get efficiency of speed and all that, then it's worth looking at these companies. But like I said,
the key for investors is why, if I think this is a smart play, yeah, is that customized chips, you know, ASIC chips, etc., are a hot area, simply because if you can get yourself an NVIDIA chip, you're paying $10,000 to $20,000 for it. It does everything singing and dancing, so there's lots of stuff you don't want it to do, and you're paying for it. And more importantly, it draws an enormous amount of electricity and power. So if when you want to put it into EVs, for instance, and it's sucking up so much on the battery's power, then that's absolutely useless. Or using it at the edge computing out in the field where, you know, you've only got batteries powering these things because there's no actual cabling, et cetera. So, I mean, it makes perfect sense. It's customized. It does exactly what the end user wants. It's very price competitive, and it's hugely less on the power requirement. And if you want another data point of the, you know, ASIC market, et cetera, customized chip market, just go and read the last quarterly results from Broadcom, because they are just saying they are seeing an enormous amount of demand for customized chips from their, you know, people like Apple and people who want their services. So
yeah,
you can guarantee the demand's not a problem here.
Yeah. So what I didn't understand yesterday, right, is that Alpha Wave Semi, like I said, they announced a deal, extended deal with Samsung. I didn't see it in RNS anywhere. It's like, not RNS. So they do silicon IP, chiplets, all that, custom silicon, connectivity products, data centers, and they extended with Samsung, right, with Samsung Foundry. And yet they're including 112 gigabytes per second Ethernet and all that, and also the chips. And I thought, why wasn't this RNS? I don't understand.
That sounds like it's a supplier, not a customer. If they're using Samsung's Foundry, they'll be delivering that chip to the end customer. Samsung doesn't say, they sound as though it's supplier.
So Samsung Foundry platform now, customers now benefit from Alphawave Semi's most advanced high-performance connectivity IP and chiplet technologies, including 112 gigabit and all that stuff. So they supply that to Samsung Foundry.
I don't know whether they are the Samsung Foundry of making those chips for Alphawave then to deliver to their end customer. I don't know. You'd have to look. You'd have a look at it and just see whether is Samsung the customer or is it the supplier? And I suspect
they're the customer. They are supplying Samsung their 3nm process node. So they're supplying them with that and their IP chiplet technologies. And
send them an email in the company.
Why was that just buried on your blog? It's like send it out a bit, you know?
Because crazy.
Samsung, you know, quite a well-known customer.
Yeah, I know.
You've heard of them. So that's one. You said you've made some more investments, yeah?
Yeah. No, well, I mean, I'll just get up there on another one. I did actually make on MicroMerce, which I said I bought last time, yeah? The premium brick build. I did actually touch base over the last 2 weeks with the CEO. And he was pretty, you know, sort of positive. Frank Hanna, I was just trying to remember what his name is. He's leaving actually in about 12 months to go to Brickability. The shares are just hugely undervalued. You know, basically their P&L is pretty much, I mean, there's no doubt about it. It's more challenged the housing market and the brick market than it was 12 months ago, because what happened after the trust economics, they slowed down new build houses, and it meant that lots of the distributors and the housing building boys effectively ran down their inventories and didn't order. So that was a big draw. But actually, you know, the inventory levels across the industry are still pretty much low and very low, where they're actually operating at the premium end for more aesthetically looking, products, etc. And now the house builders are breaking new ground and starting. So, you know, I'm pretty much optimistic. He just reinforced to me that this is a rock solid business, good long-term fundamentals in niche markets with good pricing power, great relationships. And the one issue that I had was basically, you know, in terms of energy hedging contracts, what would that mean? And essentially what I think is going to happen, reading between the lines, is that they're just going to, if they don't sell any, you know, if volumes did sort of like, you know, turn down at the second half, which I don't think they will, because we're putting, you know, basically new houses up in the start breaking new ground. But if they did surprisingly turn down, then they're just basically build to inventory because they need it. I mean, they are desperately short of inventory because they, you know, their stock days are super short, super, super small compared to what they should be, you know, for proper service levels. In fact, they are limited across the industry. So, yeah, I mean, you know, the whole industry has been sold off. It's baby in the bathwater stuff. And I'm absolutely delighted that I picked up a full position in that one. So, yeah, that was the last bit of the jigsaw. The one thing I would say, just returning to Sondrel and to Alphawave, that people, if they want to get into that space, need to be aware. The biggest risk is effectively that it's lumpy contracts. You know, basically, if you do cost to, you know, complete on your contract, and essentially some revenues fall in the wrong side, then, you know, you're basically of a period, et cetera, then it'll hit your numbers. That's the only sort of downside, is that there is some lump. But with Michelmerce, you don't get that. It's continuous. And I could see them doing, I mean, you know, I could easily see this 150 rather than 90p. Easy. And it pays a good dividend. It's got a great balance sheet. So I was pretty much impressed.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see you know, some news from house builders of late to see how what's happening there.
The trading statements are good. They're all good. You had Chris Nicholson's, you've had Persimmons, Taylor Wimpey. They're all saying the same. The one thing that is knocking them a bit is that cladding issue. But that's a benefit for, you know, for the likes of Michelmersh, because they do system, you know, brick systems to be able to replace the cladding.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, so if anything, it'll be supportive to them.
No, I definitely want to say, but I mean, I don't, again, Gleeson dropped out and I sort of just sold. But I definitely want to get back into a house builder, you know, for when we see some clarity. Because I think at the moment we are literally, if house prices go up, bonds are going up, like I said, and interest rates are going up, I just want to see how that will knock the market a bit, because I know from personal experience the market is very slow at the moment. You know, and I've been speaking with lots of estate agents. It's slow. It's hard work. So, I just want to see how that works. Because it's like, you know, getting mortgages, it's just gone up, and it's a bit scary, really.
It's tough. I'm certainly not saying that we're seeing a huge back, you know, buoyant housing market. But I actually think something like Michelmersh, being a niche, you know, product supplier, they'll either get bought out by somebody, or by the time the, you know, basically the slowdown finishes, they'll be in a much even stronger position, you know, competitively wise, to really, you know, to do well when the upturn does occur. So yeah. I think it's a good place to be, to be perfectly honest. I mean, another one which is on the sort of like the OTC or healthcare products company, which had a capital markets day, was VentureLife last week. And what they did was lifted the lid on their long-term, you know, sort of like forecast, what they're hoping to do. I mean, you can't criticize them for not lacking ambition, because they are looking at 100 million sort of like revenue line over the next 5 years, which is about double from where they currently are for this year, which is about 50. And they're significantly undervalued at the moment. I mean, I think house brokers got a target price. Singers have got one about 84p, and I think they're trading at about 40, so half of that. But if you look at doubling the revenue over the next 5 years and driving higher margins, because more of the revenue will come from their own products rather than from third-party distributors, then that's going to totally, you know, if they can pull that off, it's just going to drive that share price higher and higher and higher. So, if people are interested in buying shares, I would strongly recommend they get hold of the presentation from the Capital Markets Day, because it's a real eye opener, and it gives you about 120 odd, 130 odd slides actually about the business, about the relevant divisions, all the product usage, the distribution strategy, the marketing, etc. And they've got a good front bench team there, and very good growth drivers. So in this market, to double your business on a high margin, I mean, this is like, you know, 20% plus type, you know, potentially, you know, EBITDA margins, easy, even, you know, 25.
I went on a rabbit hole then, looking, you went back to semiconductoring. I had to go back to I'm just saying, they in the last trading statement, the CFO stepping down, the mess up in the numbers, really.
You're talking Alpha Wave again.
Yeah, Alpha Wave, really detracted from some of the achievements they had. They just achieved their first quarter of 100 million in bookings, right? First 3-nanometer design win with a top American hyperscaler. And now they've got Samsung. And I was looking, I just went down to looking at manufacturing processes and the size of them and how fast they're coming down. You know, and literally, they've gone from, in 1987, 800 nanometers was standard, you know? And 800. And every year they're just coming down. And now that 3. And now the future, they say, that's the future right now, is 3. But next is 2 in 2024. But it's phenomenal, the pace of growth of technology, and technology enables technology. But so hopefully, and also just worth looking at the chart of Alpha Wave, just sort of broken out of its previous high after going down for a long time. So I think maybe it may be starting a little uptrend. But that area is very good area. But you said you've got to be a bit selective. But we're only going to need faster, better chips to process more data. Like I said, in more efficient ways in the future, aren't we? You know, AI gobbles up so much data. It's phenomenal. I know.
Power as well, importantly.
Yeah, power.
You can find which makes a lot of it for the customized chips. Another one I've bought on the medical devices area is Inspiration Healthcare. That's ticker IHC, and I've spoken to their CEO Neil Campbell just recently, and he sort of reiterated my thoughts. It's a rock solid business. It's got two elements. About 2/3 of the revenue comes from its own sort of like neonatal baby ICU ventilator heating sort of products and stuff. So when a baby is born premature and it's obviously, you know, it needs some help, etc., whether it's the right temperature or the right breathing, etc., it uses the, you know, it can use the Inspiration Healthcare's sort of like, you know, devices, etc., that help them to recover and to get through. And they sell all these devices in the UK, Europe, and out in Asia. And they're trying to get actually approval for their standard ventilator out in the US as well. So that should happen over the next sort of like 18 months. But the shares have been sold off last year, largely on the back of because of the China lockdowns, which was quite a big market, and Russia, which was again another hit to them, etc. They still grew top line, but they missed their targets, and therefore, because of what, you know, we talked about illiquidity, etc., then the shares have been knocked down. So the main part of the business is their own IPR. It's all of that sort of like, you know, best in class baby ICU units, prenatal sort of like incubators, etc. And then the other side of it is infusion devices that they sell into the UK. They've got a license from a Greek company who do these sort of pumps that help patients maybe feed themselves or take drugs intravenously when they've got finished on cancer, etc. And that's done well also. Anyway, to cut a long story short, they're through their troubles. They also had supply chain issues, chip shortages, surprise, surprise, last year. They're largely through that. They're still struggling actually on their supply chain to get, you know, consistent supply. And so they're having to hold stock, which they did. That drew down some of their, you know, sort of cash at year end. But those headwinds are now easing on a like-for-like basing effect for next year, and they expect to sort of grow. I think it's roughly around about to about 45 mil turnover for this year, and then really sort of start accelerating for next year. And just on the sort of the valuation wise, I mean, you know, I would say this is easily a sort of like, you know, 10 times EBIT type businesses looking at, you know, over the next 12 months, 18 months, and I get a target price of 80p compared to a share price of 46. So I've struggled buying liquidity. I've bought probably a 2/3 position. If it stays where it is, I'll pick up some more shares. I need another half or so in Sondrel, as I talked about. But I think it's a really good company. And Neil's been around, you know, for ages in terms of he knows the ins and outs of that business. And, you know, I'm very much optimistic. They've got a bit of debt at the year end, yeah, but that should, with the cash generation, that should become a net positive cash position by year end, which will then give them the balance sheet strength to then consider, you know, sort of M&A, et cetera. But again, if it stays these levels, I would not be surprised if somebody puts a number on them and buys them out. But
worry about liquidity? Sorry, I've been more aware of that now. I mean, just looking at, you know, Inspiration Healthcare, like average daily volume is pretty much 27 grand. You know, in total traded. Do you worry about that? Sorry, it's more than that, 170. So it's double that.
Do I worry about it? Yeah. If it makes it annoying, to perfect honest, I don't worry. As in, like, you know, if I want to chuck in quite, you know, a decent position, then it just takes me ages to get in. And obviously, if I ever wanted to sell it, it would take me ages to get out. But I do, you know, as I've always said, I'm a long-term investor, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. So short-term volatility, you know, as long as the investment thesis is fine, it doesn't really worry me much at all. But it is annoying, let's be clear about it, in terms of I can't get in when I wanted to get in, and you can't get out when you want to. So it just takes a lot longer. It's a bit more sort of like, you know, time and patience. But no, it doesn't worry me because, you know, I trade through that noise. But
for example, I mean, you know, if something goes wrong with an individual company and you've got a big chunk in the, you know, a company that's small and you know, you can't get out. Is that, I mean, did you say that?
Oh, I can. I do. I dump the shares. I mean, I did it with Let's be clear, though, I had to do it with Rosslyn, didn't I? I did it, about 4 or 5 months ago. I mean, you sell at a ridiculously low level. I mean, you just got to accept that if you're going to go into these things, they're difficult to get in and they're difficult to get out if you want the sort of, the long-term upside story. It's just part of the risk. And if you have to sell and drive the shares down, you have to sell and you drive the shares down. But I've got no intention on, if anything, I'm going to add to my Inspiration Health and I'm going to add to my Sondrel shares on it. But lots of things are really illiquid. I mean, I'll come on to the third one I've bought in a moment. And even that's a much bigger company. I've struggled getting shares on that one as well. So
yeah, but when you're chucking 10 million quid in, when you're trying to build 10 million quid slots there, it's hard work for the money bags, Paul Hill. Oh, Paul's on board. Here we go.
Anyway, yeah, I mean, the third and final one I've bought this over the last 2 weeks is TPI Cap, which is basically the world's biggest interdealer broker. I mean, it effectively does liquidity. It does, executes trades for institutions in things like interest rates into swaps, foreign exchange, commodities, energy. They'd also do sort of like, really, really big pieces in their LiquidNet acquisition, which they did about 2 or 3 years ago. Anyway, the shares are ridiculously valued. They're about 6.5 times PE. They pay about 8% or 7-8% dividend yield. They've got cash on the balance sheet. I mean, it does need capital for its on a regulatory purposes for that sort of stuff. So that's their sort of bread and butter stuff. The whole sector isn't valued highly at all, and that's because people have this view that actually voice broking is going to zero, and it isn't, because these are highly sort of customized trades that people want to do, whether it's in sort of forwards or in currencies or in commodities and this sort of stuff. So they're very specific to the customer. So voice broking will always there, but it has put a bit of a drag on that growth. But anyway, the base business will grow. But the real sort of crown jewel is their Parameta data business, which has really attracted me. And again, this is another stealth AI play in my view, because the trading mechanism of the base business, it collects all of that data and then sells the data to lots and lots of different financial institutions and, it's people like Bloomberg and Reuters and people like them, Retinif and people like that, who then use it because they can actually then see pricing and volume data for, non-over-the-counter, non-listed, products and stuff, and do charts or whatever they need to do. So this is really valuable data. It's almost... it's 98% recurring revenue streams. I mean, it's enormous. It's growing. It's sort of like, high single digits, double digits per annum. It's got 50% sort of like, contribution margins, 40% EBIT margins. And on that basis, given that this is a sort of like, it's unique data that they own, you put sort of like really neat sort of AI algos on top, and you can then really sort of drive that top line because nobody else can capture that data. They've got unique proprietary data there. So how much was that worth? Well, it did about 80 million of EBIT last year. You stick a sort of like a 15 times multiple for a very, very high recurring revenue, highly profitable business on it. 15 times EBIT is not exactly that expensive. You get 1.2 billion. The market cap for TKI Cap is currently 1.2 million. So it underpins it straight away. And then how much is the rest of the business? Well, you get, so even if you only put sort of like a 5 or 6 or 7 or something like that, EBIT multiple on the existing business, you get another 800-900 million on top. And when you look at it through that lens, I get to the market cap or fair value target price around about £2.50 compared to the current shares and about £1.60. And on a sum of the parts, I think HSBC have got a target price of 290. They've got an actual overall target price of roughly around about 220. And I think Peel Hunt have got about 240 price target. So significant upside. The difficulty is to separate Parameta without actually having any tax leakage out of it, not incurring a big, sort of tax bill. And I think they're working through that. But they do realise they're significantly undervalued, and they look to sort of like, release some of that hidden worth within the actual group. And it was highlighted to me by Christopher Mills and Gervais Williams, and I've bought some shares. I've got a full position now, but I even struggle to get some liquidity even in a share which is worth 1.2 billion. It wasn't amazingly liquid.
Yeah, no, it's odd because I you know, fill out the spreadsheets and stuff like that. I do put that in, so average daily volume, and then divide by 10, seeing how easy you can get in and out. So if you look at that, 140 grand, I suppose, you know, that's with 1.4 billion, I think. But you know, I saw Christopher Mills and Gervais Williams, actually, worth watching. If you haven't seen Paul interview these guys, and in fact, Christopher Mills highlighted on the market, and that's very interesting, actually, how that's come down. Yes. And it's one of those things where it's not a relationship with the valuation, what they're doing. They've got this drip, drip, drip sell of, you know, of agents that are allowed to sell now. And that's the problem with the stock. It's very liquid and it's taken it down. Now, I don't know when this dripping will stop, but I think then it'll start to rebound very quickly after that because the fundamentals of the business are quite good and the valuation is very good. And like I said, it's a portal where, so they don't have to own lots of stock or sell lots of stock. Literally, just trades getting done, deals getting done. And so their technology offer is very good as well. So I don't own holds, but I've been watching them on the chart thinking, when will the sell-off stop here? Because it's getting to silly levels. It's getting to silly levels. You know? In fact, it bounced yesterday, and you'll see that happening.
What isn't at silly levels at the moment? Yeah. It's like crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
So I was just top level. I'll post it sometime over the weekend or the next week or stuff. I've now only got just over 20% of my portfolio held in cash. So most of it's in stocks, and I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 stocks. Wow. My increasing. So hopefully I'll get another two or three over the next few months. But I'm very happy with what, you know, basically with the new purchases, you know, Inspiration Healthcare and Sondrel and TPI Cap.
Yeah. I'll have a look at Sondrel, actually, because I think, I didn't realize there were semiconductor companies that small around. So it's very interesting, I think. You know, if they can improve
The thing is, as I say, the Sondrel, it's basically, its key focus is in that, you know, the digital sort of like accelerated computing power, the chips. So it's customized accelerated computing. It's that down to that 3 nanometer, which is where the industry wants to get to. It's not on your mixed signal type of digital and analog. It's in the real sort of like the hyper growth stuff.
Yeah.
But it is lumpy contracts, so it's not without risk.
Marvelous stuff. Okay, well, I'm going to start buying some stuff, I think. You know, I've got a bit of cash. I haven't got many stocks. I mean, do you know what? The only thing I'm actually regularly paying into, because I think rather than sitting cash, is like an, you know, high dividend yielding fund, which is a BlackRock fund. IUKD is the ticker. It's basically, a FTSE 350, high yielding stocks. I mean, I'm just so bored at the moment. I'm waiting for things to happen. I mean, so, yeah.
If you want a high dividend paying stock, buy a TPI Cap. It'll pay you 7 or 8%.
Maybe I'll do that. Yeah, I mean, there's plenty around, but it's like, do you know what? I do find smaller stocks and microcaps more exciting than bigger stocks. That's it. And I thought, should I look at both, or should I just have a fund for one and then just go for it? You know, spend more time looking at microcap stocks. So I do find them more exciting. You know, they are more exciting. Full stop.
Not if you own Nvidia.
No, I know. Yeah, exactly. Well. Saying that, it's just got a bit nuts, isn't it? I mean, there's a guy.
I could handle it, though.
I can handle it, but it's like, are we in bubble territory there? And that's why I don't know. I'm a little bit cautious. I don't know what I'm waiting for. I'm waiting for something. Certain stocks I'm looking at, but I just want them to come back a bit, you know, because I'm thinking they've rallied a little bit and they've come off the bottom, but they may need to sell off. And they are largely small, macro cap with, you know, IP. Validation by bigger companies, all that stuff. But
the key thing to me is, what's your time horizon? Okay, and if you're concerned it's this year, then I can understand your hesitancy. But if you're looking through this year or next year, and you're happy to hold for 3 to 5 years, as long as the investment thesis is fine, then you're going to do well, in my view, very well. But it can be rocky for the next 6 to 12 months. Who knows what if the economy goes up and sentiment goes up and down, then it's unlikely we're going to see improved liquidity. Higher cost of capital for small caps is going to be a continued headwind. But once that breaks, then the valuations will correct very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Fingers crossed. Marvelous stuff. Cheers to that. Cheers, it's a long one. Speak to you in 2 weeks' time.
Bye.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.